Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray! There's a chorus of one because Anthony is not here.
Yay.
Hello, so I'm your usual host, Richard Nicholas. Or am I, dramatically pulls off mask?
To reveal me, Abigail Bain. Or is it?
Jamie Thomas, as I tear off my own plasticky face to reveal...
I am, in fact, Richard Nicholas all along. Ah, this film is full of mask pulling, so that explains that stupid intro. Welcome to the show. So, guys, our mission, which we chose to accept... See what I did? Yes, see how clever I am. Was Mission Impossible 2, because the first mission was too easy for us, so we just moved on to the sequel. It was Jamie's choice. So, someone give us the details of MI2, as it reads on the poster.
Mission Impossible 2 was made in 2000. A secret agent, Ethan Hunt, is sent to Sydney to find and destroy a genetically modified disease called Chimera. It's directed by John Woo, written by Bruce Geller and Ronald D. Moore. I don't know who either of them are. It's produced by Tom Cruise, which you can totally tell because it is basically a Tom Cruise vanity project. Mm-hmm. It had a song by Limp Bizkit that everybody remembers because it was the Mission Impossible theme with Fred Durst shouting over it a lot.
Yeah, there's pretty much, you know, two things people remember about Mission Impossible 2, and it's Limp Bizkit doing the theme tune and exploding sunglasses, and that's about it, really. Maybe a motorbike and a cliff. That's about all I could remember when I first, like, recalled it, as you suggested.
I watched it yesterday, and that's all I remember.
It's going to be a short review, then. But yeah, you mean, why Mission Impossible 2 for us to do in our special film club that we chat about stuff in?
I wanted to pick... My idea was sequels that are, like, bizarrely different from their predecessors. And I like the first mission. Apart from this one, which I kind of like in a way, I like all the Mission Impossible movies, but the first one is very much the best one. Mm. And it's a... For the most part, the first one is a spy thriller. It's actually quite... Like, one of the criticisms of it when it came out was that it was too complicated and people couldn't follow the story. Because it is quite dense and you have to really pay attention and the plot is, you know, it's all about intrigue and double crosses and all this kind of stuff. And then Mission Impossible 2 comes along and just...
ups the tempo and ups the explosions and ups the madness.
And reduces any risk of being complicated.
Yeah.
The first one is a spy thriller with some action, some pretty good action peppered in it, and then a load at the end. Mission Impossible 2 is just an action movie, and, you know, Tom Cruise trying to show off about how cool he is.
Yeah, Mission Impossible movies have become this thing where it's kind of the American equivalent of a James Bond film, in a way.
Yeah, and it is exactly the way you would expect Americans to do James Bond.
Sure, it is. And it's all... you know, the coolest gadget they have is what? Like, exploding chewing gum in the first one?
Yeah.
But then it's like, you know, bike chases and somehow racing a car, flirting and crashing. I don't really... I mean, Bond sometimes does a bit of fast driving to impress a lady, but Tom Cruise seems to crash into his lady to save her and then force her to love him because he saved her from the crash he caused.
Yeah.
It's a bit brash and weird is what I'm saying.
Any opportunity he can take to fire a gun upside down or at a strange angle, preferably in midair if he can manage it.
Yeah, why shoot when you can jump and shoot? Why jump and shoot when you can flip, jump and shoot?
Why kick a guy in the face? Why kick a guy in the face when you can run up to him and do a backflip into his face?
Let's do everything you'd normally do, but with more 360 degree turns. It's amazing in that respect. It really goes full-blown, jump about, explode a lot, and you kind of expect that from John Woo.
You compare it to, you know, the most famous scene of the first film, where he's dangling in front of a computer for, like, 10 minutes with a lot of really quiet tension.
Yeah. Silly though it is. It's quite a contrived, stupid way to spend a while dangling with lots of unnecessary perils, but, you know... it made sense on paper, and it kind of is exciting when you watch it, the first one, I mean. Do they have a dangling thing in all of them? Like, four, they have a weird levitating one. It's slightly different. It involves, like, stupid magnet stuff. And in this one, it has some dangling. And then in the first one, the dangling.
Apparently in the third one, they do too.
There are lots of lasers or something in the third one. Like,
I can't remember. I don't remember the third one very well, which is a problem with the third one, is it's too generic and just is forgettable.
So, yeah. I mean, anyway. Abby, your thoughts coming into Mission Impossible 2?
I didn't particularly remember Mission Impossible 1, except that it was as silly as the TV show, but with more money.
Sure.
So that's more or less what I was expecting when I came into this.
Yeah, because what? The TV show was in the 50s or 60s, sort of?
60s.
60s.
And that was all like special hidden rooms and disguises and, you know, shoe phones or whatever they had as gadgets. Like, I don't really... Yeah, I haven't seen that much of it. They had pretty weird gadgets, though.
Yeah, they were quite high concept, but low budget.
Yeah, sort of, you know, if you have a suitcase, it's obviously going to be a weapon as well, isn't it, kind of ideas.
Yeah.
But yeah, this Tom Cruise vehicle, you hadn't seen it in a while. What was the thing?
I just so happened to have not seen it for quite a while. I didn't avoid it or anything like that, like I do with some movies. But, yeah, I had moderate expectations. I was expecting it to be silly, but okay.
Yeah, we don't get to do too many high-budget action movies, mainly because they're either too good or they're so bad that people have done them to death. Like, usually if a movie is a high-budget American action movie, everyone's happy to have a chat and a laugh about how stupid it is. Whereas Mission Impossible 2 is kind of... I just think it's obscure enough for us. It's not that... Like, it hasn't lasted and become a classic like, say, Die Hard or something, has it? So that's why we're going to chat about it some more. I just, you know, had seen it at the time, thought it was rubbish, forgotten about it, and then we watched it again, and I just... I took it in a bit more, and, you know, it's still lame, but... Let's find out why. You see it as being, Jamie, a big tonal change from the first one. Is that?
Yeah, because it goes from being that. Abby used the phrase. No, you used the phrase Tom Cruise vehicle, which the first one isn't. Like, the first one is just a film and a story in and of itself that stars Tom Cruise. Yeah, whereas this is like Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible 2. Look how awesome he is. Yeah, climbing mountains with no safety net.
Shooting
a gun upside down. And look how many different sunglasses he wears. And
yeah, exactly. Look at him on motorbikes and do kung fu. Like, what?
Yeah. Tandy Newton's on top of him again.
Yeah, because the initial setup of the first one is essentially we're spies, let's plan the mission, do the mission, oh no, it's gone wrong, let's find out who the mole is, oh no, oh my goodness, all the people that aren't Tom Cruise are dying, and John Voight's going to be the baddie in the end, and everyone's going to peel off masks and fire guns, and then Gene Reno's going to be pulled into a tunnel, which he then navigates in his helicopter somehow without dying for ages. And I think he tries to kill Tom Cruise with the helicopter in the tunnel. I don't know how that scene works.
Well, all I remember from the first one when I think about it in any kind of brief way is Knock List. For some reason, that sticks out.
They
weren't
Knock List. It involves... Yeah. It's in that era when, you know, they had loads of cool gadgets, but all of their things are like, do you know, it was in that era of the 90s where... Do you remember back when laptops and phones had that extra dimension? I think it's called depth. Like, they just, everything's thick. It just has that, it has like four sides or whatever. Now everything's thin and flat.
You said as well about like the 90s. Another difference between the first film and this one is that the first Mission Impossible, in the trend of things being adapted from TV shows into films in the 90s, the first one is very much Mission Impossible, the movie. Like, it's one step away from being called that. And it starts with the theme tune from the show. And the intro sequence is very similar to the TV series. It's almost like if it wasn't a spy thriller, it would be very similar to the Flintstones movie. In that it's like, you know, look, we're taking Mission Impossible and we're putting it on the big screen. Whereas Mission Impossible 2 is just an action movie that is called Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, it sort of links up and ties in, but fundamentally is its own beast.
Yeah, and yeah, you can watch this without watching the first one.
Yeah, if it didn't have the theme in it, I wouldn't necessarily have clocked it.
And of course, no, they have to do, yeah. I mean, it has Tom Cruise, and he does a bit on a wire for a bit. The things that happen in Mission Impossible films, people peel off masks to reveal stuff. Tom Cruise does some dangling, and there's a theme tune that, you know, people remember from the TV show and know now. If in this one, in a weird OE sort of Limp Bizkit, bomp, 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 like extra loud, annoying way. Oh, new metal. It's weird that new metal is old now. So is it old new metal? Is there a new kind of new metal?
I think it's just classic rock now.
It's just been... Yeah. Just because you've got some turntables being scratched doesn't mean it's any different to the rest. It's rock and roll just like Elvis used to do. Oh, well, you know, Mission Impossible 1, there's some chewing gum that makes stuff explode. There's some giant laptops that seem obscure now that we're in the future. And a bunch of people reveal themselves to be, you know, traitors by peeling off masks. And John Voight does some more standing on a train. We've already had a film. Jamie, I don't think you were here for... What was the film, Ab?
Runaway Train.
You weren't here, were you, Jamie, for that one?
No.
Well, John Voight in Mission Impossible 1 gets back to his standing on trains ways of the film Runaway Train, where he stands on a train and screams.
Why are you talking about Mission Impossible 1?
Because I bothered to watch it before watching Mission Impossible 2.
and it is better.
Yeah. I had some thoughts. It isn't brilliant, the first one, but never mind that. It is, you know, more grounded than... Well, it's not grounded at all. There's a stupid bit where a helicopter's being towed through a tunnel in a train with Tom Cruise doing a lot of stunts, and yeah, it makes no sense, but it ups the stupidity in Mission Impossible 2, which we should be talking about. So the opening, I believe, is the first mask reveal double bluff thing, isn't it? They're on a plane. The guy Boris the Blade from Snatch, he's a scientist now and he's ill and stuff, and he's on a plane. He's meeting Tom Cruise, but Tom Cruise is a baddie. What's going on? No, it is the villain revealed that underneath the Tom Cruise mask, it is I, some guy.
Dougie Scott.
Yeah. So that was our kind of pre-credits opening, wasn't it? What do we have any thoughts on what we first witnessed as the Mission Impossible 2? Here we go again, guys. It's MI2.
Bad CGI of the plane and Hans Zimmer's unusually mediocre score make it feel like a TV movie. Like this, it feels like a particularly thrilling episode of Baywatch.
Okay.
The weird thing for me was that sort of distracted me from the CGI, I think, is that because I didn't remember, number one, I didn't know why he was calling him Dimitri all the time. It's like, pretty sure that's not his name.
Why is he calling him Dimitri?
Well, he's a spy, isn't he? He knows him as someone else.
So is Ethan Hunt actually called Ethan Hunt, or...?
I would assume so.
Well, you wouldn't pick Ethan, would you, as a first name?
Well, like a lot of the film... Like a lot of the things in this film, the answer to that question is, who cares?
his name's Hunt. Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
And the Hunt is cool, but the Ethan, not so much.
He didn't even want to say it when he saved her in the car. And she asked him his name, he kind of went, Ethan
Hunt.
Much like how they pronounce the antidote to the virus, Bellerophon, where none of them seem to know how to say it, so they go, Bellerophon.
Isn't it called... Oh, so the virus is called Chimera, which is like a mythical lion-tailed... snake-tailed lion thing, isn't it?
It's a monster with the head of a lion and the body of a lion.
And the tail of a snake. They love that sort of stuff. Greek and... Greek mythology, or is it the other one?
They said Greek.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Greek.
I don't know if they were right.
Ah, who cares? That's the big catchphrase. The point is, the main MacGuffin of this is there's this naughty scientist who's come up with a horrible virus, oh no. And that is the thing that all the baddies want to get hold of, slash that and the antidote to create money from making a virus infect people and then having the tablets to get rid of it or whatever, you know. That's the...
And that is... Yeah, that is pretty much Dubley Scott's entire motivation. We never find out if there's any other reason why he's doing any of this beyond the fact that he wants lots of money, which I presumably he already has because he's an IMF agent.
Yeah.
And they seem pretty well off. And I guess he fancies Tandy Newton and that makes his boyfriend jealous.
But nothing is quite like the payout of having lots of stocks invested in a medicine company that just so happens to have a virus antidote that everyone suddenly needs. That's satisfying to watch your stocks rocket upwards serendipitously. Oh, no, it was just a coincidence. I invested millions in a company and then happened to be connected to the virus that was unleashed upon everyone. It's just a coincidence, honestly. That's more fun. That's more of an evil, isn't it? But that's the thing. That's all we need to know as far as you say, the director's concerned. Bad virus, make it go away. Tom Cruise has to come in and get the virus because he works for who exactly?
IMF, the Impossible Missions
Force
Federation. I don't know.
Are they like a wing of the CIA? What do they? Do they exist? What's with that?
Who cares?
Yeah. Anthony Hopkins is boss. Who cares?
Anthony Hopkins told Tom Cruise, "Oi, we've got a thing for you to do. We need you to get a virus, but it's going to involve sexually manipulating a woman into doing your bidding."
No.
No.
He didn't say that, though. Well, if he had have said that, I would feel better about it. But what he said was, "There's a virus thing. You need a woman." That's pretty much what he said.
He sends Tom Cruise after Tandy Newton's character.
Yeah.
Like... And it basically says, yeah, Tom Cruise is like, oh, I thought you just wanted to be on her team. Like, the reason they picked her was because she had a previous relationship with Dougie Scott's character. Dougie Scott's character is also an IMF agent, and he's, like, doubled for Ethan Hunt in the past.
Hence the handy masks around.
Yeah, he was and also, it as, yeah. Also, I like how in-depth their relationship is explored, like, their past relationship is explored. They're like... He's doubled for you in the past. What did you think? Oh, we had our reservations about each other. The end. Yeah. Like that. That's all you know about Dougie Scott and Ethan Hunt. And it's built up as if, like, they're these, like, rivals who have been enemies for years. Like, that's how it's portrayed. And it's just never explored.
He's no 006 to his 007.
Yeah, that's what I thought. This is like a really rubbish version of Trevelyan and Bond in GoldenEye.
Maybe they just spent a bit of time together because the other guy was trying to learn his mannerisms. And he doesn't even need to learn his voice because they get that weird, inexplicable sticker with like computer chip stuff on that makes your voice exactly like someone else.
Yeah.
But, okay, back to the mission starting. The interesting thing, the money shot that it opens with of Tom Cruise is interesting because the mission has to be delivered to Tom Cruise, who isn't available. He's off doing that usual leisurely pursuit of climbing the epic landscape without any harnesses in the big... Like, what desert is he in anyway? Like,
he's in Utah.
Climbing the big orange rocks without any equipment or help.
Which is, like... It's one of those things about this film that's, like, shallowly impressive. Because, you know, everyone knows how nuts Tom Cruise is, and he did that and got filmed.
Well, he even did jumping from one ledge to another ridiculously.
Well, like, he wasn't as high as, you know, the film makes him. But he was high enough that it made the production company very nervous. But
like on a stool.
Yeah. That's pretty high for Tom Cruise. He's not very big.
First short joke.
Yeah, it's going to be a load of them. No, but, like, it's impressive. Like, the way he does it is impressive. And it's one of those things, like, a lot of the action sequences that happen later in the film are kind of like, oh, wow. And then you think about it at any kind of depth and you just go, yeah, no.
What I like is a man who thinks, ah, time off. I know what I'm going to do. Go alone to climb some rocks. How, like, at least take a friend, guy, you know?
I like that when the like the helicopter finds him on top, they fire a rocket with sunglasses at him. Like, oh, good thing that didn't hit him in the face.
Also, like, how hard is it just to like drop just a brick with a note attached to it or a suitcase, something pedestrian that you can, or just shout from the helicopter, Tom, pick up this walkie-talkie a sec. Yeah, hello, mission. Do you want one? This nothing's going to explode. You just accept or don't. We could have phoned you, but you turned it off. Yeah, do you want the mission? Yeah, I thought. It's well paid, yeah. Yeah, Anthony Hopkins. Oh, yeah. You'd love it. Right, see you. Do you want a lift, actually? No, you're up here. Are you getting down? You want to come in the helicopter? You want to come in the helicopter. Land it there. You know, it's just, that's how it should have gone. Not rocket launcher, sunglasses, put the sunglasses on, hear the message, throw them away. They explode needlessly. You know, on earth?
This was 2000. Not very many people had mobile phones at the time. So I don't know if you remember how hard it was to get a message to somebody, but the number of times I had to charter a helicopter and load up a rocket with a shopping list in it.
But also, what I like is it's kind of topical for the now in 2014 when we do this, that Google glasses are becoming a thing that's going to be foisted upon everyone and they're going to be underwhelming, but then eventually everyone will get used to them and we'll be all wandering around like the Terminator. But it would be the sort of topical thing they jam in a modern one now if they were making an action movie. They'd just be like, yeah, put glasses in with the message because, you know, that's the future, isn't it? Messages in glasses. Yeah.
Yeah, but then it would be, they would be some huge, massive billboard on top of the mountain that said Google on it.
I will say, there seems to be a thing, based on the first movie, that it is one of the common things in the movies is they have special sunglasses and glasses that film and show you things, and they'd like gadget glasses in Mission Impossible movies, it would seem. Yeah. So that's a trope, I guess. So they've ticked that off nice and early. Tom Cruise has had his bazooka sunglasses mission, and he's presumably choosing to accept it because he's made some offhand remark about, you can't tell people where you're going on holiday. It's not a holiday, even though they found me anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And he wasn't exactly, you know, inconspicuous.
He was very conspicuous, if anything.
Yeah. Like, it would be different if he was just sitting on his settee.
Maybe a smidge easier. He wouldn't have to helicopter if he was just in.
Yeah, but like they wouldn't, you know, they know him well enough that they wouldn't think, oh, he's just at home. He's sitting at home watching Risky Business. That's weird. Tom Cruise is in it too.
Or if he's just like, oh, where is he? Oh, so we've tracked him to somewhere in Beijing. We're going to be a while. There's a lot of places, a lot of rocks to look under. You know. So, yeah, I feel like we've got as far as the credits at least, haven't we? That's good. So we have the old bump, bump, dump, bump, bump, dump, dump, bump, bump, dump. Look, it's cool angles of weird bits of, what is that? Something on fire. What's that? Oh, it's a string. What's the string for?
Yeah, I guess it's a really stylized fuse.
I suppose. What's the, like, there's not really a fuse on anything at any point. Everything just explodes when you just bump it a little bit in your car. So I don't know what the fuse relates to. Maybe the original TV series had a long fuse that they had to
light. Yeah, that was the credits, is a fuse would light and then it would go along to the theme and the credits would run. But this is like a really like ADD version of it.
But what's happening? Is there like an Acme sized like bomb, like a big black ball with bomb written on it that's been lit now? Like what is the gadget that's been facilitated? You know, a fuse doesn't say to me espionage. It says, you know,
yeah,
gunpowder, treason and plot is what it says.
It worked back in the day. I can say that for Mission Impossible TV show, is that the opening credits worked.
Yeah, we'll let it go. They moved on with the times. I was a bit disappointed when in the Limp Bizkit music video, he sort of beats them all up dressed as chefs or some. No, Fred Durst beats people up as a chef. Or there's chefs being beaten up. None of that happens in the film. I was disappointed, is my point.
I never saw the video, but I'd be disappointed too.
I just assumed that the music video was part of the film.
There were two. There was that one, and then there was Metallica's I Disappear.
Oh, yeah, and he's like...
And they're like they're on top of the mountain, and you see Tom Cruise climb in, and yet he never meets them. You'd think, no. You know, he gets to the top of the mountain and goes, all right.
That always irritated me about that video.
But in a way...
I'm assuming he's reached no one.
If in the film his holiday had been to go to a VIP, him-only Metallica concert on top of a massive orange rock, you know, that would, you know, you'd I'd probably, again, want some friends with me, but that's a cool holiday. Metallica in the desert on your own.
Yeah.
VIP, pretty good. It'd be harsh if they didn't, if they made you climb, but... Oh,
not if you didn't have to pay.
Yeah. So, in the end, it just turns out that the girl was saved by them in the helicopter, and they live happily ever after, so... I think we finished that one. I'm sorry, I feel like we spent a long time. It's my fault, I've been rambling on. The film, what happens in the blooming film, eh? What's the thing he has to do?
Tandy Newton is stealing a really ugly necklace by putting it between her boobs.
Yes. And we have to have lots of like misogynistic shots of her various nice parts.
Yeah, while she sits on top of Tom Cruise, because he, you know, is producer, and he's like, yeah, let's put Tandy Newton on top of me.
Maybe she should say something kind of suggestive and we should switch places. That's more like it. Yeah, there we go.
But then, he makes her give the necklace back and she gets annoyed, so he gets in a car and runs her off the road and she kisses him.
Yeah, that's how I follow up all my investigations into people.
Yeah.
It is very strange. It's that weird, I'm going to flirt with you while racing thing.
Yeah.
And after stopping her, essentially she's like Catwoman without the disguise. She's just a thief who, is clever because she can walk in a room and look for a thing.
Pretty much,
yeah.
Like, oh, I better stand around this corner and wait till a guy goes past, then run in while the dancing covers my footsteps. Like, I could be a spy, or I could be a illicit spy thief if it just involves looking around a corner to see if anyone's coming and then not opening a thing.
Not only is she a thief, though, she's built up as like a world-class thief. Like, she is one of the best.
She didn't even do that thing all thieves do in movies like this and, like, cut the circular glass pane out. Like, Tom Cruise does that later. But, that's the classic thing. You cut a circle in the glass and pull it out really slow on a suction cup. And you slip in with, you kind of do your weird body-bending acrobatics to get to the vault and stuff. But she doesn't do any of that. She just, like, gets, come on to by Tom Cruise, as you say.
Yeah.
Abby, as our female representative on the team...
No pressure.
Yeah. Thoughts on how this lady is portrayed. I mean, how do you feel about it?
Torn. Because she isn't a weak woman. She makes lots of decisions for herself, and she is quite in control of her own situation. But all of the attitudes of the men towards her is repugnant.
They just kind of throw her around. They just chuck her in there, and they're like, fine.
Yeah.
If anything,
and they say horrible things to and about her. A lot.
If anything, the men come out really badly, and we should feel affronted, Jamie. We should feel like men are being portrayed terribly, and women are just, they just happen to be attractive, and they should be left alone, and we're horrible about it.
Isn't she... I just realised she is the only woman in the film.
Yep.
This one has a lot more. Like, a lot of the members of the team are female, and, like, a key, like, people to the mission are, are in it, are female, and it's not a big thing. Like, so, it's not a... They're not all just there as decoration. Or
And, like, it's not to take away from, like, Tandy Newton, because she does actually try and do a decent job with what little she has.
Yeah. She's like, acting while being hot, and that's fine.
Yeah. Well, other than, like, Dougree Scott, she seems to be the only one who, like, invests anything in her character.
Yeah, she tries really hard. And she wasn't given very much.
Yeah, she doesn't have that many scenes, really. She basically has to talk to herself at the horse races and pretend that she isn't talking to Tom Cruise on a earpiece or whatever. And how does that work? She has a earpiece at one point that also is a microphone in her ear.
Pretty good.
They stand there talking in that scene, and she doesn't look like a mental person at all, standing talking to herself. And she has to worry about the fact that she's injected herself with the virus. What else happens to her?
She gets better.
Yeah.
She's ill for a bit, and then she's okay.
She has to be really close to Tom Cruise.
And not look taller than him.
Yeah, that's
hard.
It's very hard to maintain a seductive look and stoop.
I was thinking, actually, that she's quite a slight lady. It hadn't occurred to me that Tom Cruise is tiny. So they probably picked someone who was very small in stature.
Well, apparently she was cast on the insistence of Nicole Kidman, who was married to Tom Cruise at the time. Which seems weird.
That is How strange.
It's like she thought, right, what woman do I want to watch my husband kiss on screen a lot?
That's weird.
Yeah.
That's quite unsavory and has unsettled me at my core.
Well, she's in the team now. She's going to be used.
You say she's in the team. She's more of a tool to be used by the team.
Yeah,
by sending her to Dougree Scott's inconspicuous beachside mansion.
Yeah, just because Hannibal Lecter just goes, by the way, we just picked her, not because she's a Feith. I mean, she's hot and all that, but no, it's because she's in a relationship with a person we're trying to steal stuff from or find out about. That's it.
But he basically says, she used to be in a relationship with, I keep calling him Dougree Scott, the character's name is Sean Ambrose. She used to be in a relationship with Sean, and he does, he basically literally says, well, she had sex with him before, so she'll probably do it again. And then
you know how women are. You know,
yeah.
Dirty women.
I don't know how that got by where he said,
I don't know.
She needs to attract a man and lie to him. She's a woman. She's got all the experience she needs or something.
And I can't work out whether that was done to make his character seem like heartless, because Anthony Hopkins' character is never built up in any way. He's just Anthony Hopkins. They don't give him enough dimension to give him lines like that to make you think, "Oh, you're a hard man."
It's the sort of thing where you go at the end, you'd be like, "Ah, because he's a villain. I get it now."
Like, yeah, or he's like a casual misogynist or something. But nope, he's just there.
He's besties with Bond, so they're all a bit horrible.
Yeah,
it is a weird bit, and. But like I say, that you know, they've got basically Tom Cruise goes, "Oh, you could have said before I went and you know seduced her with a car crash. Now I feel awkward telling her I don't actually love you. I need you for a mission. You're not gonna like it. It involves your ex-boyfriend, and I want you to do as much as you can to make him think that you're still in love with him. Basically, use your womanly wiles on him and do whatever he wants so that he isn't suspicious." Yeah. So we can, what is it we want? Virus thing?
I'm not quite sure how her doing that gets them the virus.
Well, of course, when he has accepted her back into his inner circle, she can just pop to the fridge and get it from his floppy disks. I don't even know what he has, to be honest. I don't understand the story, even though it's pretty simple.
What does happen, though, is it does bring up the most entertaining aspect of the film when she turns up at his house, because it suddenly Hugh Stamp, Sean Ambrose's live-in lover, becomes very jealous of the new girl on the scene. Like, I could not read Sean and Hugh's relationship any other way in that they were, like, in a civil partnership and suddenly this ex-girlfriend has turned up and he's now insanely jealous.
I don't think they were in a civil partnership either. I think that Hugh Stamp had the wrong idea about things and now he's gone nuts because he thought it was one way and it's not. It's totally the other way.
Even the next day, a really homoerotic scene where Sean puts Hugh's finger in the cigar cutter, which, you know, is not in itself homoerotic, but the way it's framed, where he's behind him and they're both kind of grunting and pushing up against each other.
It's oddly symbolic as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like, in a way, it's odd that we're discussing the sort of homosexual undertones, because it isn't Top Gun, which people tend to assume is the one of the Tom Cruise movies that is the most filled with that kind of stuff. But
well, I think you're right. There's a Tom Cruise homosexuality trilogy.
Cocktail.
Top Gun, Interview with a Vampire, and Mission Impossible 2.
Oh, if in name alone, Cocktail is a delicious double entendre. But yeah, you're right. The man is known for his films that make you go, is this actually about gayness? When in fact it's not meant to be. It's just, you know, people can read things into it. And people like you, Jamie, with your interpretive brain, thinking too hard about it again.
I think it's got
I think it's got more to do with some people just can't do macho, but they keep trying. And yeah, that's what makes it not work.
Yeah, there is a thin line between, like, being just hard and being, you know, village people, like, buff.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the plot. What was happening? There was a cigar cutter and suspicion about the new woman, and basically she infiltrates them for a bit while Tom Cruise finds a hacker and an Australian comedy man.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's no plan.
Yeah. They just, like, shove her in there, and then they go out into the outback for some reason.
Yeah.
Like, I guess this to make us as hidden as possible. Somehow they still have internet access in 1999 outback Australia.
That hadn't occurred to me. Yeah. What had occurred to me was that they could only use one computer to track her. And that is the worst idea ever.
And it also has, it must have really high bandwidth, because the, like, real-time footage of her walking around from a satellite image is moving at, like, real-time speed.
Well, yeah. I had AOL dial-up in 2000, and I can tell you that it was pretty fast. Like, the way I could slowly see one picture after I clicked it as it loaded in bars was amazing.
Yeah. It only took one day to download the music video for System of a Down's Toxicity.
Nice. But all that, like, that's the stuff we pick on. It's just broadband speed and, like, you know, it's not even broadband, but still, like, that's our problem with it. But yeah, is there a backstory to the Australian guy? What's he even do?
He's there. That's there. He's just there to be Australian. I don't know what. Okay, this was another thing that stood out. There's no reason for it to be set in Australia. It just is. And there's a bunch of Australians and British people.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I thought maybe it was that weird sort of national prejudice thing in America where they don't like actually putting America in peril and things unless they're going to be explicitly saved from the peril. Whereas in this, they were just sort of, it didn't get threatened till quite late.
Yeah.
And they didn't want it to be believable, so they couldn't possibly set it in the US. It was weird. It started to become conspicuous, because Dougray Scott was Scottish, so.
And you've got Richard Roxburgh, who's Australian, playing what I think was South African.
Yeah.
But he starts Australian, and then he becomes progressively more and more South African as the film goes on.
Yeah, it's like when he meets the Australian, borderline, you see the difference, yeah.
Yeah, until he's borderline incomprehensible.
It is weird. But I think it's just a sort of, do you like how Bond films have to be a different country? They sort of, at least part of it gets themed by a location. Like, so it's sort of like, oh, well, how many times can we blow up the Chrysler building or, like, smash into something we've seen a million times?
In a Bond film, it's usually like, how many different countries can we fit in one film?
Yeah.
Mm. Whereas in this, it's like, I'm going to Australia. I'm in Australia. That's it. They just stay there.
I wanted more takedowns with, like, didgeridoos or maybe hiding in a camel pouch or something. Not a camel, yeah. I mean a kangaroo. Camel pouches don't exist. Contrary to popular belief, neither does a kangaroo hump. That doesn't exist either.
And Tom Cruise sits and watches the roof of the villain's mansion, presumably knowing that they're probably having sex in there, which is just that's weird.
Just sitting there, fingers crossed that the yellow dot doesn't move closer to the red dot.
Goes outside and he just goes outside and looks slightly upset at the sunset. Oh. Just so you know he's human.
There were too many moments of I am still and there is music. Yeah. Oh my god.
But the whole time it was still the music actually is really weird in this film. The score is by Hans Zimmer, who is pretty, you know, well respected, and he's done some really great film scores. So why is this so bizarrely mediocre? Apart from, like, a couple of points where it suddenly gets really good and then goes back to, like, a guitar being strummed slightly fast and some speedy percussion.
Yeah, it's like, was he
medicated or something? What happened?
Just he was blackjacked, and actually when he turned up to the, like, I guess casting would be the thing you'd go to, or whatever the meet. No, he's not the cast. So when he was, like, asked by the producers, when he left, he peeled off his own face and revealed some mediocre guy who wasn't any good.
Well, like, it seems like he scored the film with a single electric guitar, a Casio keyboard, and some samples from his own score from Gladiator. Like, that's pretty much how he wrote the music for Mission Impossible 2.
Ah, well, doesn't matter. What's the phrase? What's our catchphrase for this?
Oh, who cares?
Yes, exactly. The big black guy, Marcellus Wallace, is that his name?
Yeah, Ving Rhames, yeah.
He's back, because he was such a convincing hacker in the first one. You always need a big, burly, black dude in a weird suit, I don't know.
He has got my second favourite character name in this movie. His name is Luther Stickle.
Stickle.
But Sandy Newton's character is called Naya Nordorf Hall.
Is that a part of Lord of the Rings mythology? Is that a location on the map? Like, what's that?
I don't know. It's like they wanted to make it every nationality that exists.
The film is so, doesn't care about itself. Looking at the cast list on IMDb, I don't remember any of these characters' names other than Ethan Hunt, Sean Ambrose, and Naya.
Yeah.
I don't even remember those.
And McCloy, because they kept saying it, and they said it in such a weird way.
Oh, McCloy.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
The point is, the film is up and running. We've got a problem now in that the woman is suspect, and because, you know, she's talking to herself and going off on her own to meet strange men.
They go to a horse race, which is thrilling.
Yeah. How come they keep picking the winner as well? That's really weird. They shouldn't be in. You know, if she's a thief, then she could always pick the winner of a horse race.
The best, one of the best moments of the film, like, there's that whole sequence where he's got, I can't even remember what he's got in his left jacket pocket.
Just a memory card.
The memory card.
That's it, yeah. And she's, like, steals it from him, and then this world-class thief puts it back in his right jacket pocket.
After everyone
goes, they telegraphed it so much.
Yeah,
well.
It is amazing how they just go, but which pocket do you say it was in? I said the left pocket. Well, I mean, why do you need to know that? Yeah, but it's the left one. The left pocket, guys, okay? Yeah. Oh, I've been distracted because a man was following me for a bit. Oh, I think I'll leave the bet behind and walk away quickly and look suspicious and then put it back in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Plus how, you know, the guy, she pickpockets him, and he doesn't notice. She puts it back, and he's like, "Oh, I feel her putting something in my wrong pocket." You know, if he felt it, he felt it. If you put it back in the wrong pocket, you might, you know, go, "Oh, that's weird. I thought it was whatever." You know, like you might just shrug it off, but he feels her do it this time. So she's obviously rubbish.
She is. She's a rubbish thief.
And you know, she basically has to be talked through it all anyway. I mean, not all of it, but. They spend an elaborate amount of time making sure she has a earpiece that, you know, she didn't need, just to be told, look, here's the earpiece, put it on. Okay, I'm going away to hide now. What's it for? Oh, it's just to point out where Tom Cruise is. There he is. Oh, yeah.
There he is, immediately behind you. Yeah. I'm going to show up, blow my cover, and talk to you anyway.
There's no need. Tom Cruise should be like, I'm watching you, yeah? Don't be terrible. I don't spend too much time with the red dot in there, right?
Oh, it is the creepiest shot of the film, though, when she, like, is in the crowd and then turns around and suddenly Tom Cruise is behind her.
Don't turn round. Dude, I'm turning round. I said don't turn round.
Yeah.
Why?
You turn round. I know.
Oh, you blow my cover, even though no one can see me.
Yeah.
But luckily the Australian guy was there in an elaborate costume to slowly bump in, like just to bump into the henchman who was following her, because that was so necessary that they meet. And I guess they needed to see the memory card and then put it back, but it was only to go, look, scary virus.
I love that. Ving Rhames, just reading the captions on the photos as you were looking at them.
I love that Tom Cruise was there, right? And he stayed there while Ving Rhames from the van runs all the way over, hands him the camera, then runs back with it. It was so unnecessary. It was like, Tom, you're here. Why didn't you just have the camera on you and, like, put it in yourself? Like, no, I'll make the big black bloke run everywhere.
We're at a horse race where nothing happens. Somebody has to run somewhere or something.
Someone has to do on horseback and explode. So what happens after all that debacle? They find out, oh no, it is a nasty virus that makes you look all bloody and stuff when you're dead.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's a bit hazy from there because there's no plot.
But something, like, basically, back to the unmasking to reveal stuff. The suspicious bad guy decides he will put on one of his classic Tom Cruise masks that he has because he was a double. It makes sense. He puts that on, runs into the back garden, waits for her to run out thinking he's not.
Hoping she does.
Hoping she comes that way when she's scared and all the lights are off in the house. And then awkwardly chat with her, very knowingly about what she's on about, considering he shouldn't know anything.
Yeah.
And then not kiss her and look a bit evil when she goes away and then peel off the mask and go, ha ha! That's why Tom Cruise is being horrible again.
You do have a great evil look from Tom Cruise, though, that makes me think he should play more villains in films.
Good villain in Tropic Thunder. That's my recommendation, as Tom Cruise is a villain. Sort of Rain Man as well, but he redeems himself.
Collateral.
Yes, there are some good Tom Cruise movies. Let's watch these instead.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of, like, legitimately great Tom Cruise movies. He's been in some classics. It's just
when he's in charge of them.
This isn't one of them.
Yeah.
So
what happens when they realise that she's basically, you know, a bad... basically, she's working with whatever the American version of MI6 is.
Well, I presume they, like, put her in a box or something, because she disappears.
Wait a sec. MI6 is the Bond thing, but Mission Impossible is the name of this film. What's their agency called?
IMF.
IMF. That just sounds like a brand of DIY store.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just a bit confused why MI6 was not...
No, because, like, these films are abbreviated to MI, and he's a spy, and he works for IMF. It's very easy to get.
Thank you. That's good.
Crosswired.
Because I am confused. Mainly because presumably there'll be a sequel that is going to share its name with the Bond franchise is ripping off.
Two more films and it'll be MI6.
Well, I mean, one more and it's MI5, which is already a real.
Yeah.
This is confusing. It should be called, like, the new one after Ghost Protocol, which they decided to call the third one or fourth one or. Yeah, the
fourth one.
The fourth one. So. The next one should be called MI5. MI5 versus MI6. Or, no, MI5 versus MI5. Or,
why not just call it Impossible Mission instead?
Plausible Mission. Obviously, they must not be that impossible if we can get through one of them and have a sequel. Yeah. Anyway, the film I'm trying to talk about, but keep needlessly tangenting off of...
I want to tangent again.
Oh, okay.
To complain that this wasn't an Impossible Mission. It was just a bit awkward. It was an awkward mission.
Inappropriate.
This was more like, I don't know, MI kind of fits because this is Mission Incomprehensible.
Yeah.
It's just like none. Yeah, you're right though. They don't. Neither side has a plan.
Yeah.
Like they're all just kind of stumbling around in the dark, but with a bunch of really expensive gadgets that they could, you know. Presumably construct, cobble together some kind of plan from, but no, we're just going to guess a lot and put this woman in loads of danger.
It seems like most of the things could be achieved if they just, you know, have a SWAT team storm the house. And if they don't want to be inconspicuous, can't they just, you know, gas the dude in his house, knock him out, look around his house, you know, like... Well,
they clearly know, and presumably IMF has enough authority that they could just kill him and then cover it up.
It is a bit suspicious that there aren't easier ways than, you know, using old relationships. But they did, and it goes wrong, as, you know, it has to. What happens once she's found out? Basically, I don't even remember how we get to massive explosions and bike chases, but can you guys help?
She vanishes, because nobody cares about her, because who cares? And then they put Tom Cruise in a building through the roof.
I've never wanted to see Tom Cruise have a sort of Acme-style splat, as I did want him to go into the slats on the top of that roof.
I like the fact that he just goes, even though, like, they're like, oh, something's gone wrong. It's not even clear what's gone wrong. And they're like, don't jump, Tom, and he jumps. So it's like, he's that confident that, nah, I'd be fine.
It's just, like you say, Abby, it is that thing of, oh, go on, smack your head. Because he did say it isn't right. The hacker guy said, and the computer says, no, you shouldn't go. And yet, is the attitude Tom Cruise had. I know better.
Yeah. And then he does like an action movie equivalent dangling of the really well done dangling scene in the first one.
It is just, oh yeah, we need to have that dangling scene that is apparently a Mission Impossible trope now.
But we need to do it better, so Tom, do a backflip.
Yeah, just do a needless backflip, and then once you're in there, you can just get out and it'll winch up, and it won't be half as tense and elaborate as it was before, and you can just wander around breaking science stuff.
Which, oh, and he does it so slowly.
He could have, like, and the other thing is, the thing that's weird is all the tension is lost because the bad guy's going, I bet I can predict his plan exactly how he'll do it. He won't come in through the bottom, he'll come in through the top, but he'll probably smash everything. So what we're going to do is at the very last moment, disguise as, like, you know, security or whatever, which Tom could have done, presumably, wander
in. They come in disguised as themselves.
Yeah.
They just walk in the front door and shoot everyone.
Yeah, the guys even say, what are you on time for once? It's like, these clearly aren't the people relieving you. They're not in uniform or anything.
No.
They're just some guy.
But Tom Cruise has got ahead of them a bit because he's been smashing everything slowly, but they turn up and he's got one last thing that he can smash very quickly and leave. But they decide to have a massive pointless shootout over it and needlessly drop the suspicious looking injection gun and just get glass everywhere and...
Another one of my favourite little things, that's like inconsistencies, is he spends all that time putting a mask on to like shield himself from the virus and very slowly sneak into where all the three Petri dishes are, turn the heater up to burn them. And then like after he's vaporised the virus in the Petri dishes, he plants a bomb.
So you have to slowly ninja your way in, but also you can explode your way out if it all goes to pot.
Why not just plant the bomb?
Yeah.
Why plant the bomb anyway? Because the virus is now gone.
Yeah.
Why bother with this drawn-out sequence? Just plant the bomb and leave.
But, you know, dramatic stuff has to happen and be exciting, and it isn't, but it happens anyway. Tom Cruise goes... Basically, he nearly gets the woman back, doesn't he, at this point, or...?
Yeah, they say a bunch of horrible stuff about her and put her in jeopardy again.
But they wait. Like, Tom Cruise is the thing. He can destroy it and, you know, they'll be screwed. But they go, let's hold out on showing we have the woman hostage and stop him giving it up straight away. They kind of hold back on showing her. Then they show her. Then he goes and tries to rescue her and goes, it's awkward because I can't say it. Look, I know. You can only save yourself. Leave me here. It's fine. And he kind of goes... Okay, and then he just blows up the wall and jumps out into the sky.
Not knowing whether he will... Yeah, it just... Well, it's a way to escape, I suppose.
It's just the whole, why can't you save her? Because you can shoot them and she'll get hit by bullets if she comes with you as well. Like, what's the problem? He doesn't have a parachute spare?
Well, yeah. And, oh God, I don't know. This whole sequence is... Like the rest of the film, so it fits as a mess. and also, Ving Rhames is in a van, and somebody blows up the van.
But he survives.
And he has his one computer, like you said, that they do everything on and decide not to back anything up.
Lesson for life, kids. Always back up your stuff.
Yeah.
Even in, you know, put it up on the cloud, as it was called now in this time. I don't know what you guys call it in the future there, but... The cloud, like it's some kind of weird Care Bear land where we keep our pictures of each other on Facebook. But upload your things. Make a duplicate. Yeah, sorry.
That was a public service announcement.
But for whatever reason... Yeah, why does... Like, basically, when they show Marcellus Wallace exploding, he gets snagged last minute and kept there. Then it explodes, We don't see him escape the blast. Plus, he's really close if he did escape and has been burned to death. Even if he's outside of the explosion radius, he'll still die from the, like, you know, the explosion itself. And yet, he's just covered in soot.
Does the sequence where they trick the guy into thinking he's going to die come before or after this? I can't actually remember. It's before, isn't it?
I think so, yeah, because they had to know that...
Yeah.
They had to know that the other guys didn't have Chimera to know to go and destroy us.
So they kidnap McCloy, who's in charge of something, and they put him in quarantine, and Tom Cruise disguises himself as the Doc from Deadwood, and then... and then makes McCloy think he's going to die, and McCloy basically admits, I'm a bad man, all I want is money. And then they gas him and put him in the back of his car. What?
I didn't really understand what happened, because he does go in the back of a limo. I thought he was being kidnapped by the baddies. Then he's being kidnapped by Tom Cruise, who's dressed, as you say, by... like Boris the Blade, or I mean, what is the name of that like guy who's always Russian villains? He's in like Taken 2 and stuff, isn't he? The doctor who made the virus and is now dead.
I don't know. This was the first thing I've seen him in looking like this. Yeah. I may have seen looking
right from the get go like he's in a bad disguise,
which is handy for the film because people are going to peel off his face and reveal themselves to be other people. But whatever, all that they do that for, they take the evil corporate guy, but is it McCloy? The dude from In Bruges?
Yeah.
Yeah, with his weird accent.
He's doing a weirdly British accent, even though it doesn't sound right, because you're kind of like, ah, where's the top of the mornings? You know? but he is the evil corporate guy who wants to do all this naughty stuff that they want to... He's the guy who sort of owns the virus? Like, what's the deal?
He owned the laboratory where all the science was happening.
And he was manipulating the scientist that is now dead.
Yeah.
Yes.
And therefore, Tom Cruise needs him to just confess a bit.
So they know for sure, I guess, even though they kind of knew anyway.
So they fake drug him and kidnap him and all that.
Tell him he has the virus.
And then they put him back in the world.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that he went through all of that, which surely would be a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And yet carries on his deal with Sean Ambrose regardless. Like, doesn't think, oh, I'm really in over my head here. This is clearly a dangerous situation. No.
Yeah, it's like, what would it be like if I got the virus and it was lame and, they, you know.
Yeah.
It was just he basically had a dream sequence, which was akin to, like, a Christmas Carol. Like, he should have had some kind of second thought, shouldn't he?
Yeah, but no, he just carries on going to the tiny Australian Alcatraz owned by Sean Ambrose.
It is I, the ghost of murder past. You murdered me, Mr. What's his name? Clutch, was it?
McCloy.
McCloy. You killed me, and now this was what will happen to you, to you, to you. Ah. Like, I just would have liked to have seen that little Christmas story. Oh, anyway, we can't make sense of it, but... The point is, the plot moved on, and so should we. What is now to talk about?
She has the virus. Sean has her. He takes her to a weird little, I guess what is... Yeah, it is like a little Alcatraz. It's like a little abandoned prison thing.
Mm.
Just off the coast of Sydney, I guess. And they dump her in Sydney, presuming that she won't just go to the authorities and tell them everything. Yeah.
But then she can't, because she'll pass on the disease... Even though she won't, because she's in the helicopter later and everything seems fine.
She does exactly what any sensible person would do. They put her in Sydney and she immediately wanders off into the wilderness, which they should have known she was going to do.
It is a bit weird, isn't it? Because she could selflessly just kill herself then and there, really.
Like, did they just put her in Sydney in a populated area and go, right, stay there, okay? Don't wander off where there's no people, because... That's not what we want you to do.
Yeah, we're not going to...
No, because everyone will be
safe. Yeah.
No, stay there.
Yeah.
You're not listening.
They don't even have the antidote mass-produced yet, do they? It's just, it's really quick, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
If we drop it on the way, we've basically killed the world, but...
McCloy didn't even give him a time. They said, how quickly can he make it? He said, oh, really quickly once I got some. That isn't a time. It could still be a day. That's more than 20 hours.
Oh, it's honestly, it's fine. You put it in like a special cocktail shaker. You shake it up, but then you just pour out two amounts of it, and you've got twice.
Yeah. You drop it in some water, and it fizzes up. It's horrible to swallow, but it works.
Yeah, you just, it's fine. It's like you do the whole Jesus and the loaves and fish thing, and you have more. It honestly is cool. I'm literally working on another one right now as we talk. Here we go. I've got another one. There you go. It's that quick. It is that quick. I honestly don't know why we haven't done it sooner. But, yeah, for whatever reason. I mean, it's nice of her to put the virus in herself to, you know, defuse an awkward situation and then wander off and kill herself but not quite get to it in time. Meanwhile, Tom Cruise and his persona of Ethan Hunt
Well, he infiltrates the island, and this is where, you know, he becomes an acrobat, because he runs onto the island and then jump in, drop kicks everybody. I like his stealthy infiltration is running up to people and kicking them in the face.
He does every version of every WWE like drop kick you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like every like even, spinning kick and lariat.
He even does a spinning leg drop on one guy.
He does.
And not even like he doesn't even kick him in the head to knock him out. He just kicks him in the stomach and rolls him down a hill.
That's because wrestling is more real than you think, Jamie. It hurts. So when he's done the atomic leg drop in all the guards. What happens? Because there has to be a point where we get to the cool bit where he's firing guns on a motorcycle and explosions everywhere.
The deal is going down between Sean and McCloy, and Tom Cruise like comes in and he blows up the door, which I guess is perfectly safe when you've got vials of a deadly virus.
Yes. There. And then pigeons first, though, isn't it? There's lots, Abby. Well, like you liked the bit of the pigeons, was it?
This is a John Woo staple.
Pigeons.
He likes having doves fly around in his films.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a bunch of pigeons, and then he blows up the door, and suddenly they're doves, and they fly past.
I love the bit where he was just being... He was sort of... He'd climbed up, and he was just hanging up in a little bit, and he was being totally trolled by this dove who was just there going...
And just blatant pointless symbolism. And he blows up the door and then runs past for no reason.
Wait, he didn't run past. He walks very slowly past and they lovingly look each other in the eye.
Yeah. And then he, like, because really, he could have blown up the door, distracted them all and gone in wherever he was going.
And Douglas Scott had a really strange turn of phrase as well, where they weren't near any vehicles of any kind, but he still chose the phrase, somebody run that guy down.
he sends Stamp after him. And Stamp says something. At this point, his accent has become so bizarre that it's just, you have no idea what he says. And then they have a fight in a corridor, and in the middle of the fight, Ethan pulls out a grenade, pulls the pin, and throws it a foot away from both of them.
But then they get close enough to die in the explosion anyway.
Yeah.
But this leads to the clever extra bit of revealing people to be wearing masks again.
Ethan's dragged in by Stamp and then, like, dropped on the floor, and Ambrose shoots him, he, like, kneecaps him. And he's not screaming, his mouth is shut.
Yeah, for some reason, all Tom Cruise can say is...
Yeah, which is... Considering Sean knows about and has used the face masks extensively, you'd think he'd twig.
Even if he was only a bit like, that's a bit weird.
Yeah, and then Stamp says, oh yeah, he broke his jaw. But that's not what happened.
You don't become completely immobile.
I was going to say, he doesn't say, oh yeah, I broke his jaw. Then I wired it shut for him.
Also, these masks are amazing. I mean, it looks exactly like him, but it also can sweat. The mask can sweat. Very strange. Tremendous.
What I also liked is that his mouth was taped underneath, but you couldn't see that through the mouth.
Yeah.
But you could see teeth. Are you understand?
Very, very good masks.
And then, yeah, he shoots Ethan Hunt.
With Alice.
And then, he sees the taped up finger, which I guess he didn't see before. And he pulls off his face, and it's Stamp.
You forgot to name drop the part where he explains a phrase that doesn't exist, which is to get your gun off, or to get your gun on.
Oh, yeah.
To get your gun off.
To get your gun off, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah,
so, again, in the tradition of Mission Impossible, Stamp pulls off his face, and that's Tom Cruise. At last, maybe, unless he pulls that mask off or someone else is standing there. The woman's the pulls her face off. I mean, what the heck's going to happen?
How long was Tom Cruise carrying around a copy of that man's face? The off chance that he would have the opportunity to switch places with...
And presumably the little, like, things that they put on their throat to change the voice have to be, like, specifically programmed to...
Yeah.
Like, they're each for an individual person.
Like, I've,
so where'd you get that from?
I've heard Tom... I've heard Stephen Hawking talk, and they do not simulate a realistic voice for him. Like, you know, we can't do voice technology yet. Like, one of my favourite examples of this kind of getting a mask of someone to pretend you're them is in Smoking Aces. There's a really plausible bit where, to get the guy's face mask, you have to kill him. You have to record his voice a bit and practice, then spray in your mouth with loads of stuff to sound a bit more like the guy, but then make a mould then and there of the guy's face, and then make a dubious wig. Fair enough, if you're making it from scratch, it's going to take some time. So I like that in Smoking Aces, they thought, yeah, if you're a master of disguise, you have to go to a lot of effort. Tom Cruise, though, he just has a mask of everyone. He's got Fozzie Bear in there, he's got, like, Marilyn Monroe. He could be whoever
he wants. He also had a tiny rucksack with all the stuff in as well.
But after all this mask pulling, do we finally get to some kind of crescendo?
Yeah, here is where it just turns into nonsense, as if it's made sense to this point anyway, but it becomes completely nonsensical motorbike chasing, cars blowing up. And that's basically it. Now, from now until they fight on the beach, it's just stuff going fast and blowing up.
There was even one where something was going slow and blowing up, where one of the cars had a blown out tyre. It slowed down and sort of nudged another car and exploded.
Yeah, why crash when you can flip over in an explosion and total another 8 cars? And like, and just things just explode so gigantically upon any sort of bump or, like, whatever, like you say.
Also, where are we now? Because they were on an island before, and now suddenly they're driving through this, like, forest area with civilians and normal cars. We're back on the island, on the beach.
Yeah.
They went over a singular bridge, which was wooden, that they blew up a car with a bazooka, and the bridge was fine. So that's how they got off that little bit of the island. It could have been a cluster of islands, maybe.
I don't even know how they left the room after revealing all that nonsense.
No, Tom Cruise, like, jumps out of a hole or something. That's pretty... Who cares?
He gets on a bike.
That's how he gets out of every single situation. Tom Cruise jumps out of a hole.
Yeah.
He spends a long time shooting people on a bike, but also, like, doing it without looking and sort of looking in the mirror and then needlessly doing nosies or whatever they're called. And
they...
I like the fact that earlier in the film, Sean says that Ethan will, like, infiltrate a place and make every effort not to harm a hair on a single security guard's head. But then when he gets to the island and stuff kicks off, he just murders everyone.
when the plan goes wrong, yeah, just everyone can die in a ball of flames.
Yeah.
Because there was no plan.
I'm going to run in with 2 guns and a bunch of masks, and we'll see what happens.
It's amazing they got to the end where they did, really. Because the way that, like, after all that rubbish chasing, we have the amazing, we're both going to do wheelies on our motorbikes, shoot at each other, and then jump up and hug mid-air. How do you orchestrate? How do you know that, like, you start pulling a wheel, the other guy knows to pull up and jump off as well? How do you even jump off a bike and get that high from a wheelie? Like, what?
That was another thing as well. Both of those bikes exploded, then suddenly the red bike was fine.
There's a lot of moments like that. Lots of, like, continuity slips. And that was a blatant one, because it's like, that's a ball of flame, and it's fine. Just tipped over.
Apparently, painful as this might be to think about, the original cut of this film was 3.5 hours long.
Wow.
I know.
It's almost like...
What else could they possibly have done? Have they taken out all of the gay sex scenes?
Well, they left a few of them in. pretty sure that's, like, a big reason why a lot of this film just doesn't make any sense.
That won't explain anything.
No, it would probably just be more slow-motion guns upside down and homoeroticism.
But
I imagine it would be another hour and a half of faces being pulled off.
They proceed, yeah, it would be, I mean, for goodness sake. I mean, they didn't have enough, if anything. They kind of fight like lovers slash little boy slash kung fu masters slash pro wrestler.
Actually, to be fair, if there is a proper highlight of this film, it is probably the fight scene between Sean and Ethan.
The thing is, it's fun.
Yeah. And it's like, it's done in that kind of like meaty, hefty John Woo style where they do stuff that you would not do in a fight, but it looks good and it sounds like, you know, the impact is really heavy and it's a satisfying fight.
It's a good high-octane fight.
Yeah, but there's nothing behind it. Because you don't care about why they don't like each other.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. There's not nothing behind it. They think of an interesting setting, because it's just...
No, it's just...
But you mean, like, there's no emotional, like, importance to it all?
No, but it's played out as if they're supposed to be.
Yeah. And that classic, you should have killed me, and now I've got to my gun. But luckily, Tom Cruise found his buried gun, and...
That's another thing that I don't understand. Like... They've somehow, I guess, gone in a circle, like, off the island, into civilian territory, somehow back on the island, without crossing back over the bridge, back to where he, I guess, dropped or hid his gun on the beach.
No, didn't it fall out of his... Didn't he just fall when they crashed in the...
Oh, I don't know.
It's hard to say.
It fell when they crashed, but it was really weird that he ended up standing exactly where it was.
And also, when he kicked it, it went up instead of forward.
Yeah.
It'd be quite good if he'd just kicked the gun into the guy's face. Just hit him and it knocked him out or something.
It would have been great if he just kicked it and it had just skittered forward and maybe gone off the edge and he'd gone, oh, no.
And just kneecapped as he's about to kill.
Yeah. Oh, we did actually miss the film's, like, money shot, the one that was in all the publicity, like, trailers and stuff, of the knife going right up to Tom Cruise's eye.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a genuine shot. Because Tom Cruise insisted.
But, you know...
Because he's mental, I guess. Mad.
But then... Oh, it was so worth it, the way that people struggle with a knife. And it, like, who are these people who try and stab slowly into someone's face? If they're holding the wrists, try lunging at them again. Don't press down slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
Rip your hand back and stab again. That's like another tip. I'm full of tips today. If you're trying to kill someone in a knife fight, don't slowly press... Give up on the pressing, yank back and forth, and they'll soon lose their grip, and you'll be able to shank them once or twice rather well.
Efficiently?
Yes, efficiently, thank you. So, yeah.
Yeah, then they turn up, and she's looking a bit ill in the helicopter, and Dougal Scott goes, ah, you should have killed me, so he does.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I think part of the problem with this is, if this was a vehicle for a different actor, there'll be a lot more one-liners in there. That would justify all of the nonsense.
Yeah, Tom Cruise just looks too serious for how silly the film is.
It's kind of an Arnie movie in many ways.
Yeah. It would fit if they embraced how silly and nonsensical it was.
Yeah, I can buy Arnie going, it's not Mission Dangerous, it's Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
That's why they called me in, because I'm that good.
Don't kick open the hornet's nest that is Arnie impression.
He could do the thing where he rips his mask off and be like, you thought it was the real Quaid. Like, it is. It's like, actually, no, it's not. It's Ethan Hunt all along.
The problem is you could not disguise Arnie as anyone, except apparently a massive bald woman.
You could hide a Tom Cruise within Arnie.
You could hide two Tom Cruises.
And a Dustin Hoffman. And a Danny DeVito.
Then he meets Anthony Hopkins in a gallery, I guess. And Anthony Hopkins says, oh, you did it then. And Tom Cruise goes, yeah. And he says, where is she? And Tom Cruise says, I don't know. And then he goes to the park with her.
He got the mildest telling off that I've ever seen in real life or in film, where Anthony Hopkins goes, oh, she did the mission then, but you're supposed to bring out some evidence. What happened? Oh, I burnt it. Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
Doesn't seem actually...
Don't do it again.
We don't pay you to not get the stuff, Tom. Yeah?
Yeah, it's like, what happened with the virus? Presumably, the company that McCloy works for still has all of this information, and the guy was willing to sell it to the highest bidder.
And of course, the thing with science, Jamie, like all science, is once someone figures something out, but the evidence is destroyed, no one will ever come up with these things ever again. If Newton hadn't discovered gravity, we'd still be clueless. It, like, all of these discoveries, no one could have made ever again. Like, just, I don't know. But it's okay, because he burnt it, / sold it on the black market to the highest bidder.
And then he meets her in the park and wanders off to marry somebody completely different at the start of Mission Impossible 3.
Not before we have the bit at the end of, Mary Poppins, though, where they all fly kites in, like... Just because they showed a kite when they established the shot, I just thought, ooh, are we going to have a musical number and, like, rip off Mary Poppins? And no, we don't. But it nearly did in Sydney. It could have. Would have been better. So that's my review of the whole thing. Could have been better, really. No, it's ridiculously ludicrous. I feel like we spent a long time chatting about it, so we have to keep our summing up brief and try and think of a quick rating system so we could put this podcast to bed.
I thought that it was stupid and silly, but because it was poor-faced about it, I didn't like it.
It's, in many ways, if it had known it was as silly as it was and played up to it. Like, I think Hard Boiled does a bit. Like, if you've seen Hard Boiled, you have basically a cop diving about firing guns, holding onto a baby, and it knows it's having fun, and that's better. Whereas Tom Cruise thinks he's cool, and that's kind of annoying in this.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of
the right mask to
this
rip
film
off.
Yeah, the right mask to come off and reveal. And I need someone who should be funny, but is too serious about it, so they're not. And I can't think of a person.
It's like if Lenny Henry ripped off a mask to reveal Patrick Keelty. You were geared up for disappointment, and then it was even more disappointing. So I don't like those two comedians. I'm sorry, Lenny Henry. I'm not sorry, Patrick Keelty. I can't apologise to you. But, you know, Lenny Henry doesn't deserve my criticism. But go on, think of your own.
I was just waiting for you to finish the hate there.
Oh, Patrick Keelty. No, I'm not going to do that. But anyway, go on.
I am seriously having trouble thinking of anyone. This is a really hard one
to
write.
You can think of it. Think of it a bit. And Jamie, you can have a go at it in a minute.
No. I thought of something completely different. It's when Wile E. Coyote sets up one of his traps to get the Roadrunner, and somehow it ends up backfiring and smashing him in the head with a rock. That's this movie.
Should be, you know, a well-executed plan that will be enjoying. He'll be enjoying Roadrunner before long. But unfortunately, it was made by idiots, so it went wrong. With Acme products that are going to always backfire on you. Sort of. I kind of, you know.
You get my gist.
Yeah. Thanks for your input, Jamie.
It is a bad film, and it's certainly, like, by far the worst Mission Impossible film. But it's, like, and it's not bad in a way that it has fun with itself. But it is so bad that it is kind of entertaining to just, like...
slap your head and be baffled to.
Yeah, just see how badly you can mess up something that has already previously been done well. The first one set a good precedent. It's like, yeah, just do that again. Like, fair enough, some people criticised it for being, like, too complicated. But they took that criticism way too much to heart.
But it still confused us at times. Well, mainly because the plot was so weird.
The problem with it was they tried to simplify it so much that they made it incredibly complicated.
They did. And they didn't have plans. The good guys didn't have plans. And the bad guys' motives were so spelt out and stupid, it made for no sense at all.
Apparently, when this film was in production, it started with John Woo having a bunch of action scenes in mind. Ah. And then the writers had to write the film around them.
That does actually explain a lot.
Which, yeah, really does... makes sense.
I just imagine him sitting there going, I want two motorbikes going at each other doing wheelies, and they jump off and shoot guns and hug.
It's Like, I would imagine John Woo came up with the idea of a motorbike joust when he was about 13.
Yeah.
And has been desperate to put it in something ever since.
Yeah.
Rating, I don't know, I guess if we're not going with the theme, this is like somebody played a really mediocre PlayStation 2 action game and like edited together all of the cutscenes and put them on YouTube. So you're watching all the cutscenes, but you don't even get to play any of the like gameplay.
I get you.
Yeah. You're just watching this video game trying to be as cinematic as possible.
Yeah. Fan-made cutscenes from PlayStation 1 games.
this is basically Tom Cruise written Mission Impossible fan fiction.
But he was executed by Tom Cruise, and therefore all the more baffling.
Yeah.
It is, like, it's kind of, for me, almost so bad it's good. It is in that territory.
Yeah.
It's bizarrely high budget. Like, because usually when it's so bad, it's because no one had the money or the talent. Whereas there's a lot of potential talent. It's just, it's squandered, really.
There's loads of talented people involved in this, and they just, I don't know if they all got hit in the head, or, like, I don't know what happened.
I suspect that really this film was not produced by Tom Cruise, but was in fact produced by, like, Lauren Avedon from No Retreat, No Surrender, and he would peel back his Tom Cruise mask to reveal himself. But then, secretly, underneath, he would peel back the Lauren Avedon mask to reveal it was actually Tom Cruise all along. And that we've all, and that he hasn't been being played by himself. And that in fact, good actors have been playing Tom Cruise in his other films, like Rain Man. In fact, Dustin Hoffman played both roles of him and Tom Cruise, but in the mask of Tom Cruise, which there are many of, as we know.
In a little backpack.
Yeah. So this is just summed up by someone with a layer upon layer of various people's masks on, slowly revealing them just to confuse us all the more. And,
Joe,
I don't know.
I think the fact that the big single for this film was Limp Bizkit doing a song version of the Mission Impossible theme pretty much sums up the film and everything that went wrong perfectly.
You know exactly, kind of, the music video will tell you everything you need to know. It's going to be loud, brash, stupid, and terrible, just like Limp Bizkit and their music videos.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, it is just not very enjoyable, but tremendously fun to criticise. So buy a massive load of crisps or chips, depending on what you call them, wherever you live, or nachos, perhaps you're into nachos. Get your crisps, get your friends, and criticise every second of Mission Impossible 2, because it is that it keeps giving. It's the it's the critic's dream of a movie where everything is like, what? What?
I think we should wrap up.
Yep.
I just, one last thing just occurred to me, the lyrics to the Limp Bizkit song.
Go.
The line that he repeats over and over again, "Now I know why you want to hate me."
Ah.
Well, yep. now you've watched the film, then. Yeah.
Now we know. Now we know. And with that slightly obscure Mitchell and Webb reference, we shall bid you adieu, because we are continental now, because I have decided. Bonjour, adieu, vive la France, goodbye, all that stuff. Goodbye, say goodbye, team.
Bye!
Nobody die in an explosion and make me have to come and revenge you. Abby! I hadn't got through saying don't die in an explosion.
Sorry.
It'll turn out it was Abby all along that was the baddie. She hasn't really died. I bet it's you. I'm on to you. If John Voight comes out from the left suddenly and reveals himself and then pulls off his mask to reveal it was Abby all along, I'll know that I actually am in love with Jamie and I should have just said from the beginning. I can't end it. It's this confusing.
Just stop.
Oh, wait. I'm accidentally going to nudge the podcast into something. I've survived, but it's the end. Dun, 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 dun. That's the end of the podcast. Da, da, da. I'm going to have a long editing session to do. Do-do-do, do-do. Bye.